Hello out there, we're on the air, it's hockey night tonight. Tension grows, the whistle blows, and the puck goes down the ice. The goalie jumps and the players bump and the fans all go insane. Someone roars, Bobby scores at the good old hockey game. Oh, the good old hockey game is the best game you can name. And the best game you can name is the good old hockey game.
Good afternoon, and we are here with Iceman Insights. Michael Shockley, senior writer, webmaster of IcemanManiacs.com. Myself, the Dirty D. We had a successful three games since we've last been on the air, and we got some Iceman Maniacs married off. So good work by us.
Yeah, it was a good week. The wedding of Drew and Ashley on Saturday was a lot of fun. The Iceman Maniacs that were in attendance did the Iceman version of the Jackal Suck chant to Moni Moni and Sweet Caroline in the middle of the reception.
And it worked.
And yes, it did. And I tell you, the people that weren't Iceman fans were wondering what the heck was going on. But it was really loud and a lot of fun. And congrats to Drew and Ashley. And that's the first time, I believe, that I've ever endured a tornado warning in the middle of a wedding.
Which in January.
In January, especially. You don't expect that, but... That was interesting because, as we discovered when the warning was issued, there was really nowhere there to take shelter. So, thankfully, there was no tornado in reality because otherwise we wouldn't be here right now.
I shared a table with a guy who works for Kentucky Electric, and they got hit pretty hard on the western side of the state, and that's where he works. And they called him up in the middle of the wedding and said, hey, can you get here? And he looked at his phone and said, I'm actually going to have to drive through the tornado to get to where I need to go. So why don't you call around a little bit?
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty dicey there for a little while because it looked like the cell that had produced a tornado and produced damage down closer to Paducah was more or less coming right toward the middle or western side of Vandenberg County, and that's where we were. I did hear, too, that they had placed the Monster Jam show, which was at the Ford Center, at the time. They basically put it on high alert and told everyone, be prepared to take shelter if we need you to.
Wow.
But they did not have to, but they were preparing for that. So that's something. We had that a couple times when the Icemen played at Swander, where early in the seasons there were some severe storms threatening the area, and there were a couple times when we were monitoring things to make sure that we didn't have to send everybody down into the locker rooms to take shelter. But I know the Ford Center does have a plan in place, so anyone who's ever at an Iceman game, if there's severe weather, if it's really imminent and it appears that there's true danger for that particular spot, they will make people go down into the lower concourse under the stands, which is pretty much totally surrounded by concrete. So that would be a pretty safe place to be. The seating bowl, on the other hand, not so safe.
Will there be beer sales during those kind of situations? Because if I got to be down there with 2,000 people, I'm bringing soda with me.
Yeah, I don't know. Perhaps that's a question to ask. We'll see.
Also, in the Drew and Ashley wedding, we did the rehearsal here at Wired Coffee House, and we put Ficcarelli on through the PA system for the first and second period of the Elmira game on Friday night. So as we were working, you know, who's walking down with who and working on our steps, making sure everyone knew what was going on.
Yabba dabba doo!
We heard the Nigro goal, yes. So pretty awesome stuff. So, but we get the win last Wednesday, which obviously that's a slam dunk because Matty Spaeth is on the ice.
Yeah,
being the linesman,
we always win when he's here now.
Pretty much. He's only lost two.
Wow.
And then overtime tie. We'll always take an overtime tie on the road, and then an overtime victory. Todd Robinson, he's tearing it up. He is looking good, and you start wondering, whatever he tweaked in his knee with that bad ice at the Ford Center right before Thanksgiving and the circus, boy, he must be getting healthy because he is playing some darn good hockey.
Yeah, he's looking really good. He scored his first goal since November 3rd in Saturday's game. It was the game-tying goal in the third period. And he has 11 points and is stopped the presses plus 2 in his last 8 games. So he's starting to heat up. And when Todd Robinson is playing well, then hopefully the rest of the team will follow. But yeah, it was a good weekend in general. 2-0-1 since the last show we did. The Icemen are now 4-1-1 in January. So making some progress. It started last Wednesday. We beat Fort Wayne 4-1. That was our third win in a row at home, so hopefully we can extend that coming up here. Paul Dayton played well, made 29 saves on 30 shots, and debuted some fancy new blue pants. So
as we learned from Smoke, the equipment manager, that he did order in.
Yeah, he's no longer Santa Pants. He's just Lobster Claws.
Lobster Claws will work.
Yeah. So the interesting that game, it was the first time we played the Comets since November 17th, and it felt like a non-division game. It was very finesse. It wasn't very physical. There wasn't really any chippiness to it. It felt like two teams feeling each other out that hadn't played in a while, and I don't think that's going to be the case with more games going forward against the Comets, but that just happens when two teams haven't played in 2 months. It doesn't matter if you're old rivals. You just haven't seen each other lately, so it takes some time to get the blood boiling again.
Part of it, too, I think, is Coach Crom and Fort Wayne have played against each other for a long, long time, going back to the IHL when Crom was in Muskegon. Mm-hmm. And I heard Ficcarelli last year, maybe I shouldn't quote him on this, but he, after one of the games at home against Fort Wayne, he came out, because back when he used to do the three stars on the ice, mm-hmm. and I met him in the elevator as I was doing my official work, and he said, "I just can't stand Fort Wayne. They're so boring. They play that trap style." And it's true that they, a lot of times, they like to keep that third forward back and look for the turnovers. And sometimes it looks like Crom tries to attack it, and other times Crom matches it.
Yeah.
And that was just a tennis ping pong match on Wednesday. Everyone was just laying back. No one wanted to make any mistakes, and it was it was kind of a boring game.
It kind of was, but I wrote down during the game, I wrote down road game in my notes, because it felt to me, yes, Fort Wayne likes to play that safe road game kind of style on the road, which a lot of teams do, but it felt like the Icemen were playing that way too.
Yep.
Kind of
a
lot of defensive first, try not to make the mistakes and wait for something to break where you take advantage of it. And that's ultimately what happened. It was a really tight game, and then it kind of broke open late. And thankfully the Icemen got a win out of it. There were a couple things about that game that really stood out to me. On our second goal, Todd Robinson made a great pass to Kevin Baker. That was a beautiful, beautiful play.
Well, and even did that actually reach Baker's stick, or did the defenseman intercept it and then Baker swiped through his stick and knocked it into the net?
I think it was a little bit of both, yeah. But
it was a great 3-on-2 rush,
right,
with the cross ice pass from Robinson to a streak in Baker.
Yeah. And then later in the third period, there was a play where Jason Dale made an absolutely sick between the legs pass to I think it was Beaulieu in the slot. And Beaulieu couldn't finish, but man, I was hoping that he would have, because that was a beauty of a pass from Jason Dale. And then our fourth goal was just a gorgeous wrist shot from Dylan Clark. That guy,
he's awesome.
Yes.
Max him out. Sign him up. Give him a 3-year contract.
I agree. Do what you can to bring him back and
buy
and
him
keep
a house
long term.
Just in the Evansville area, because you do not want this guy going out on the free agent market and finding somewhere else to play.
Yeah. He's the kind of guy that I got a feeling may get some invites to AHL camps next year. Now, he may not stick, but he's certainly got the skills to at least warrant a look from the higher level, because, man, he's fun to watch. But a couple notes about that game on Wednesday. The third goal for the Icemen was originally announced as Aaron Jens having scored it, and if that was the case, it would have been his first professional goal. Well, after review, they ended up changing it and crediting the goal to Nathan Moon. He actually tipped the shot. Jens took the shot from the point, and initially we thought that it was a clean shot and deflected maybe by the defense, but after review, Moon was the one that tipped it. And apparently, Moon didn't want to take credit for it. He actually didn't want to steal Aaron Jens' first goal, so that was kind of cool. That's one of those nice little good teammate kind of stories. Also, on the fourth goal, it was originally announced that Paul Dayton earned the second assist, which would have been his first assist of the season. He would have joined Karpowicz, already has one assist as well. That, after review, was changed, and the second assist was credited to Daniel Tatro. So for those of you who didn't check the box score hours after the game, you might have missed that. But Aaron Jens did not score his second goal, or his first goal as a pro, and Paul Dayton did not get an assist in that game. But we'll get to Aaron Jens in a second. He ended up making up for it in a big way in Elmira. Also in that game, it was worth mentioning that Patrick Kennedy played defense because of all the call-ups and stuff. We didn't have enough bodies on D.
Actually, I was wondering if it was hockey god karma against Crom when he benched two forwards, including one Dan Gender, early in the year.
And now he
played 8D, and now we're down to three, maybe four healthy defensemen.
Yeah, no kidding.
That's the way it works sometimes.
Yeah. I asked Patafi during one of the intermissions if Kennedy had ever played D before, and he said actually he did play some D in Idaho last year in the ECHL, so he wasn't completely foreign to the position. I thought in general he looked pretty comfortable.
Yeah, I thought he played really
he
well.
He did get beat on the one Comets goal down low. Yep. But other than that, I thought for the most part he looked pretty comfortable. He didn't look completely out of place. So
well, and what else was interesting is they brought in, is his name David Harris?
Donnie Harris.
Donnie Harris.
Although Fick called him Danny in one of the games over the weekend.
But he did not, and he played solid. But he did not touch that ice in that third period. Trying to keep track of that lead, they just went with the two sets of D, and the rookie call-up from the SPHL just opened the door. And that's part of learning experience. That's development.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that's called development.
Well, and I think with him, I agree. I think he looked pretty solid. It was one of those cases of you didn't really notice him a whole lot, and when it's your first game at a higher level, you'll take that. Not really being noticed, that means you didn't screw up, so... So not a bad debut, and he played better over the week, and he had a couple of or an assist and was plus two, I think, on Friday in Elmira in a loss. So it'll be interesting to see going forward if he gets a little more ice time.
Oh, and I expect him
I think he will, yeah.
But Crom at home with a lead against Fort Wayne is not going to stick a rookie out there with one day of practice in the third period. It's just, unless he has to, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, and something really interesting I noticed, too, in that game, Jason Dale was the 10th forward. He was not taking a regular shift throughout the game, and Kennedy was playing D. Trent Vogelhuber had been playing with Nigro and Wanstrom. Well, when we took a 3-1 lead late, he blew it all up. Crom blew it all up and reunited the Dale-Vogelhuber-Kennedy line at forward because that's been such a reliable defensive forward line all season. So when we got that lead late, Kennedy, he shortened it to 4D, and we didn't see Donnie Harris, and Kennedy moved up to forward and was reunited with his buddies on his checking line, and it was almost immediate after we took the 3-1 lead that change was made, and it was nice to see. So I think that's proof that even though some of those guys have been healthy scratches because of the numbers game lately, Crom still recognizes the benefit of having those three and putting them together and what they bring to the ice, because he didn't waste time in putting that line back together, and I was happy to see it.
Dale was a machine on that penalty kill.
Uh-huh.
And he stole about 40 seconds in the Fort Wayne end, just checking guys and stealing the puck and not giving it back up. He played awesome.
Yeah. I will say, too, I think the Comets really miss Colin Chalk. He's been out hurt. He had a shoulder injury and missed some time, and then when the shoulder was almost better, he developed a staph infection in his foot, which apparently he had one a couple years ago and got better, but now it's recurring. And last I saw, as of Sunday afternoon, I think the Fort Wayne newspapers were saying he was actually in the hospital for it.
Wow.
So hopefully he can get back healthy again. But the Comets definitely are not the same team without him. Not only is he a very solid player in general, he's one of the only guys that consistently beats Todd Robinson on faceoffs, which... to tease. We're going to talk about face-offs later, I thought they really miss him, so hopefully he gets back soon. Not that I want the Comets to do better, but you hate to hear a guy dealing with something like a staph infection. That's a really serious problem.
Now, their top line with Eric Giosa is finally back and healthy, and he's one of my favorite in the league.
He's
little number 23, and Brandon Marino, 13. They flew all over the place.
Yes,
they were dynamite. But again, we talk about depth and no real second line there.
Their depth is going to be even tested more because Marino got called up yesterday.
Oh, I hadn't heard that.
Marino got I think it was Sunday night after the game. He got called up, but we'll get to that later too.
Just
teasing machines here,
or poorly organized.
Yeah, that too. The last thing I wanted to mention about that game on Wednesday was in the first period, the Icemen had an apparent goal that was disallowed, and there was some discussion among the fans about how they could have disallowed it because the puck went in the net before the whistle was blown. And it was one of those cases of the puck was right up against the post, and the goalie kind of had it trapped next to the post, but you could still see the puck. But the referee was not in position to see the puck from his angle. He lost sight of it. He blew it dead. Well, the problem
which is the rule.
Which you're correct. The problem is before he actually blew it, the puck got chipped into the net, and it fell under one of the intent to blow rule that I think. It's
kind
of counter
my marriage.
Wow. Are we still? Is this?
Yeah.
Thing on?
Hey,
are we still here?
We wanna thank you for listening to 96.9.
Yeah. We're going
to
be signing off now forever. But yeah, it was the intent to blow rule, and it's counterintuitive because you're always told from day one when you're 5 years old and start playing mite hockey, you're told play to the whistle, play to the whistle, play to the whistle. Well, then you get to the pros, and they have this intent to blow rule, and it's play to the whistle. Or until the referee is trying to blow the whistle, whether he really has or not. And that was the case of this, that if the referee deems the play stopped and he is going to blow the whistle, even if you haven't actually heard it tweet yet, the play is dead. And that was the case on that. Because he lost sight of the puck and was going to blow it dead, the goal didn't count, even though the puck went in before the whistle was actually heard. And that's kind of a controversial rule. You hear that in the NHL every now and then, goals will get disallowed for that same reason. And every time it happens, the team that thought they scored gripes and moans, but it's not going to change. That's the way the rule is.
And the rule, even before we get into the intent to blow rule, the first rule, which it's a tough rule and it's horrible as a referee, is if you lose sight of the puck, play must be stopped.
Correct.
That is the rule. That is USA Hockey rule, and it goes through the pros.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't stand behind the net. So wherever the referees are trained to be on the goal line with the feet inside closest to the boards, but right on that goal line. But if you stand there, next time you have an Iceman skate or something, go out on the forward center, stick a couple of your friends there, and try to find a small 2-inch by 1-inch thick puck.
Yeah,
on the other side of the net. That's just the way it is, and you try to get a feel for it and everything else, but there's nothing worse than blowing that whistle and seeing that puck come loose, but it happens every weekend.
And it happens to every referee at some point. That's not that the ref was wrong, it's just that's the way the game goes. And like you said, and you were joking on Facebook to an extent, but it really is true. It's not that the ref wasn't in the right position, it's that the play was on the wrong side of the net. And he was in fine position if the puck is on the other side of the net, but it gets chipped over to the other side of the net, and before he even has time to consider going around the net to get to the other side to see it, it's too late. Because the play just happens so fast at this level.
Yeah, and you're not really supposed to go over to the other side of the net.
Yeah, you're generally
supposed
to
come up
to
the net
and stay there.
Yep, and that's just it's just the way it is.
Right.
It happens. You feel horrible, but
yeah, and that is probably 2/3 of the time you see the premature whistle blow. That's what it is. The ref is on the opposite side of the net, and it's a case of the goalie is hugging the post on the other side, and between the post and the goalie's pads, there's a window that's just a blind spot there. And if the puck sits there and the referee can tell from the other side that it's not moving for more than a second or two, generally they're going to blow it. And sometimes in the case of that, like it was on Wednesday, they blow it because they can't see it, but everyone on the other side of the net can see it. And that's when you get that outcry. But that's just part of the game. And over the course of the season, you'll lose a couple goals that way, and you may get a couple goals that way that help you that are disallowed for the other team. So it kind of balances out, you like to think.
Iceman's only championship came on the heels of 5 in one game up in Battle Creek being missed.
Really?
And blown dead, yes.
Yeah, you saw that in person.
I did. And actually, where me and my buddy were broadcasting from, we were over that goal. And we got to see the ref lose sight of it 5 times, including the overtime winner. And the Iceman ended up winning that game and then
stole
the second one in Battle Creek after they went down. Oh, no, that was the game that I think did they lose the first one and then they won the second one in overtime and then came back to Evansville and won two. So it without that rule, we may not have a championship.
Hmm. Yeah, that's well, let's not discuss the officiating in the old AHA days. There were a lot of issues with that officiating, especially with that Matty Spaeth guy.
That guy's awesome.
All right, I think that's enough about Wednesday, you think?
Jeez, yeah.
I guess we can move on and talk about Elmira. So this first segment isn't 38 minutes again this week?
Good luck with that.
Yeah, I know. So then the Iceman went on the road to Elmira. The what is it, a 13-hour bus ride, I think they said? 12 and a half or 13 or something crazy like that. Played Friday and Saturday in beautiful Elmira, New York. Lost 3-2 in overtime on Friday.
Where Brian Patafi won a Taylor Swift contest.
Yeah. Lost 3-2 Friday. Once again, the Icemen took a 2-0 lead but couldn't hold it. Again, they were up after two periods. It was 2-1 at the end of the second period and couldn't hold it. Elmira came back and they scored a minute 55 into overtime. And once again, we lose after leading through two periods. That's been the story of this season.
Yep.
But at least this time we got a point out of it, which is progress, I guess.
Indeed.
So they went from that on Friday and turn around on Saturday and went to overtime again, but this time won 4-3. Trailed 3-2 after two periods, but came back, which is the first time all season that the Icemen were trailing after two periods and come back to win a game. Entering that game, the Icemen were 0-14 when trailing after two. So that's a progress, too, making a comeback after two periods. So that's good. Josh Beaulieu scored the game winner just 38 seconds into overtime. And earlier in the game, Aaron Jens did get his first goal as a professional, and it really counted this time.
Yeah, so Chad Burley couldn't take it away.
Yeah, that he evil did Chad Wednesday Burley. Gee, he's so evil, he should play for the Fort Wayne Comets.
No doubt. Give them all the stars, too.
Yeah, like they do up there at the old Coliseum. But yeah, Jens had his first pro goal. He also had two assists. It was originally three assists, but after review, one of the assists was credited to someone else. But yeah, he added the only assist on Beaulieu's game winner in overtime. So a very good game for Aaron Jens, who I think has looked a lot better since coming back from IR. He looked a little in over his head before he went on IR. But when he came back, I think it's proof that there can be some benefit in just sitting out and watching from above and seeing the speed of the game and seeing the way the game develops at the level you're in as a spectator. And when he came back, I think he's certainly looked like a more complete player and fewer mistakes and just looks a little more comfortable out there.
That I think it was the second period Wednesday night when he drove hard across the blue line down the right wing and then centered that pass right before the net, and the Iceman didn't score, and then he got just blown up afterwards.
Yeah,
and the ref never saw. That's a tough one to see behind the net, behind the play. But boy, that was a fantastic move that he did there.
And he's been a lot more aggressive since coming back, as not physically, but with the puck. He's played more of an offensive defenseman kind of role, and part of that is because Plantin and his brother now are out.
Yep.
So there's a little more of a window for other people to step in and take on that role. But
that's a confidence thing too.
Yeah.
For a defenseman, you never want to give up that blue line.
Yeah.
And a lot of times you can just play it safe, just dump it in the corner and everything else. And it takes that's confidence when you know that I can carry this puck. I'm not going to turn it over. I'm going to give us an odd man rush. I'm going to give us numbers, a scoring chance, and I'm still going to get back to my defensive position.
Because if you do mess up, if you do turn the puck over, then it's an odd man rush the other way, and you're on the hook for it.
Yeah, and so, the coach knows it.
Right.
And so, it only takes so many of those before you're back in the press
box. And part of that, too, though, is you have to be encouraged to some extent by the coach that, yes, do that. You know, I want you to be more aggressive. I want you to take those chances. And if you get beat every now and then, oh, well, that's the risk we take. You don't want to get beat at all. But every now and then, you're going to – if you take that risk X number of times, sometimes it's not going to work out. But if you know that the coach has your back and that you're not going to be riding the pine the second that you screw up once, then that goes a long way, too, toward building that confidence and – where when you have a split second to make that decision, you don't think twice about it and you just do it. So
I agree.
The only other thing I wanted to mention, too, on Saturday's game, well, really the whole trip in Elmira, both of those games, Kennedy and Jason Dale played defense because of short on D. So we basically, on that trip, our defense consisted of three guys we've had, one guy that's been here for less than a week, and two forwards. And yet we went and got 3 out of 4 points. So that's a pretty good weekend. The other thing that stood out to me is Paul Karpowicz played really well. He made 68 saves on 74 shots, so that's a .919 save percentage over the weekend. And I went back and pulled up his numbers. since he had the 5-0 shutout at Fort Wayne on November 17th. Starting with that game, since then, he's 5-3-1 with a .279 goals against. Before that, his goals against was over 4. So he's starting to round into form. Now, you know, .919 and .279 are still not great numbers, but considering where he came from and the way this team's been playing, you'll take that.
Yeah, and the fact that he's a rookie, and again,
it's just going to take time.
This is things that happen with Coach Crum on the practice ice, away from all the eyes of the Iceman maniac, and this is development. This is how you turn a rookie into a veteran,
a legit
professional.
Pro, yeah, imagine how well these guys would do though if Crum knew what he was doing.
And yeah, that's true.
Man, it's a shame we don't have a guy that knows what he's doing.
Yeah,
we should get on that. Maybe they can hire Brian Burke.
He is available.
Yeah.
And it's funny, after that Burke firing, Patafi has had encounters with Brian Burke, and then mm-hmm. I've got another friend who's a doctor that had an encounter with Brian Burke, and they both have very funny stories about how brash and untactful and stubborn that man is. So
I've heard stories that have been made public, and yeah, that doesn't surprise me one bit.
I love it.
Who's hot?
Who's hot?
Other than Paul Karpowicz, we already talked about Todd Robinson. He's been hot. The other two guys that I made note of that I wanted to mention, first off, Anthony Nigro. I mentioned last week that he's looked a lot better since Crum shifted him from wing to the center. And I went back and pulled up the numbers, and I figured out, based on my faceoff stats.
Nice.
Yeah, another plug. It has now been 7 games since he shifted to center. In these 7 games that he's been playing center, he's got 2 goals, 4 assists, and is +1. So almost a point a game, and he's a plus. In the 9 games before that, when he was playing wing, 1 assist and -10. So I think the proof's in the pudding that he has been a lot more comfortable since moving to his natural position.
You mentioned that on the radio last week, and I was a little frustrated because I hadn't noticed it until you told it, and I was a little embarrassed. But then I went to that game last Wednesday night. He looks like a totally different hockey player.
Uh-huh.
He is just – he's end-to-end. He's flying around, and you are right. He looks super good.
Yeah. The other guy that's been hot is Daniel Tatro, and it's not – totally in the stats. He's got 2 goals and 3 assists, and he's +7 this month, which are solid stats, especially for a defenseman. But I just think, in general, the eyeball test. He started this season rough. In the home opener, he had that glaring turnover in front of the net, and I think a lot of people just, their first inclination is to kind of write him off. And, well, this guy sucks. We don't need him. He's going to be terrible. Why did we sign him? He's taking up a veteran spot. Get rid of him. But I think he has really righted the ship. He had a few more turnovers there in the first couple weeks of the season, but the last 2 months or so, he has been excellent. And especially since Plante got hurt, he's taken on more of a leadership role. He's played more of an offensive role. And I think right now he is the cornerstone on D for this team.
Yep.
I think even though the plus minus over the last few games has kind of gotten some people's attention, but whether he's a plus player or not, I think the eyeball test just shows his value to this team right now. So kudos to him. That it's one of those deals where defensemen, a lot of times it's harder to tell from the stat sheet who's being effective, because you don't know who's an offensive defenseman, who's D first, you know, who's getting power play time. There's a lot of things that you can't tell about playing D effectively from just looking at the box scores. But when you watch Tatro play, he has been excellent lately, and I think he deserves some kudos for that.
Our next segment, the only one we haven't plugged, is Shockers Hockey Rock Song of the Week.
All right, tonight's game against the Fort Wayne Comets.
Suck.
Is the annual Military Appreciation Night, which is one of my favorite promotions every season. In honor of Military Appreciation Night, this is a song, when we did this at Swander, I would always play this song, and I'm sure you'll probably hear it at the game tonight. It's often considered a patriotic anthem, but some people probably don't realize it really is not. It was actually a protest song in support of Vietnam War veterans and in protest of how poorly they were treated after they came back home from the war. So it's kind of a patriotic song in a way, but in another way, it was against the way that the military were treated, and shined some light on the way that the military should be treated when they return home, whether the mission was successful or not. So in honor of all the military, past, present, and future, This is from the 1984 album of the same name, Born in the USA, by the Boss, Bruce Springsteen.
And we are back here on Iceman Insights, listening live at 96.9 WYIR, the music bomb. He is, I like that sound effect, Michael Shockley from IcemanManiacs.com. He is the senior writer and webmaster. And if you miss any of the previous show or you can't finish listening to this show today, you can always go to IcemanManiacs.com where the podcast is saved and on file and actually in its entirety.
Yes, it's complete.
Not screwed up as I had a minor standard technical issue once again.
Yes. It's in its entirety and it's uninterrupted. There's no Brian Patafi in the middle of it.
Fantastic. So, where are we? Transactions.
Yes. All right, our weekly transaction report, long as always.
And we got the supercomputer, room-size supercomputer to continue to calculate games lost to injury.
Yes. The Iceman, through 40 games, are now up to 231 man games lost to injury and illness. Six are currently on the IR. We are now up to 43 different players that have dressed for a game. Consider the fact that in our two CHL seasons combined, we only had 51. So we're getting really close to that. We are now up to 19 different call-ups involving 14 different players. So those numbers just keep getting more and more astronomical. Going back to last Wednesday, for those who didn't hear, Brian Patafi did confirm here on the amusement park that Matt Jens is out for 4 to 6 weeks with a partially torn labrum in his hip. So he'll be out for a while. Also, as we previously mentioned, that was the day that we signed defenseman Donnie Harris from the SPHL. He was playing for Pensacola. He had 20 points in 47 games during his rookie year last season, so he's got some offensive talent. Once he gets a little comfortable, we might see him take on a little more key role as long as we need him around. Yeah, he's got some size. So it'd be interesting to see how his role evolves over time. Also last Wednesday, Brian Bisek signed with the Kalamazoo Wings. He also took along a man named Jeff Pierce, not to be confused with Matt Pierce.
Sorry about that, folks, listening to the amusement park last week. I just saw Piercy on the tweet, so I just assumed.
Yeah, it was Jeff Pierce, another player that he had been playing with this season in Missouri, I believe. And we will actually see Brian Bisek here in Evansville very soon because the K-Wings come here on Friday night.
It's going to be awesome.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing him at this level. He scored a goal in his first game over the weekend.
Well, of course he did. He's a goal scorer.
I don't think he did anything else over the weekend, but he did score a goal, so off to a good start. But yeah, the K-Wings come here this Friday and then twice in March, both on Saturdays, the 16th and the 23rd, the latter of which is the home finale this season. So Brian Bisek will be at the Ford Center for the last Iceman home game of the regular season, as long as they don't cut him before then.
I got to have a little rant here. Did you schedule rant time in this?
No, but I think that's implied in the format of this show.
All of us fans, we cannot rip on these players for leaving teams, for not honoring contracts, for not coming back and signing, because we don't know the dollar amounts that are being handed out. I had heard through rather reliable sources that Bisek never wanted to leave Evansville, but he didn't get anywhere near the contract that he was hoping to get.
Correct.
And
that's what I heard too.
And you know, when you're married, you're 25 years old, you're a human being. We all want to work for the most amount of money that we can make. And he got an offer that he couldn't turn down. And you just can't, no matter how much you love Evansville, no matter how much you love playing for the Iceman and Coach Crum, no matter how many little kids bought your jersey and you signed the backs of it, if you're getting $150 less a week or $200 less a week or whatever it is, you've got to go where the money is. And it's the same with Brian Bisek. It's the same with Jesse Perrin. It's going to continue to happen because it's the way it is. And I also, for the amount of money that these guys make, yes, they're playing hockey for a living. It is awesome. But if you don't want to get traded to Arizona because that doesn't work into your future schedule, you don't go to Arizona. You go home, and you wait for another league to sign you. You are a free agent. That is the way the system works. Now, Matt Spaeth, among others, I was talking with him last week before the game, he hopes that the CHL and an ECHL come up with an agreement that they're going to honor each other's contracts.
Which they had up until the end of last season.
And it's happened before between the Russian Federation and the NHL and pretty much all of professional hockey at the highest level, the NHL, the Swedish Elite League, the mm-hmm. Russian League. But those get difficult as well. So it is good. It is bad for myself, especially at this level, because you meet these guys, you talk to these guys. Yeah, they're hockey players. Yeah, they're athletes. Yeah, they're living the dream and playing the game. But they're not getting... They're not making that much money.
No, no,
not enough to totally change your lifestyle to go and play for a crappy Arizona Sundogs team.
Yeah. And also you have to consider the window to do this is small. Even you know, the average career in the NHL is like 3 years. So when you consider that even in the minors, you may have guys linger on longer than that. But by the time you're 30, you're old. In this line of work, 30 is old. And if you don't turn pro until you're 20, 21, that means you've got a decade, give or take, to make hay while the sun's shining. And if you feel that you need to make a certain decision, popular or unpopular, for the betterment of your career when you still can do it, while your skills are still an asset that people might be fighting over, then sometimes you just got to look out for number one. And that doesn't mean that you don't like a city. That doesn't mean you don't like a team. That doesn't mean you don't like the fans.
You're a turncoat. Right. It doesn't mean you're a Benedict Arnold or a betrayer.
It's just business. And people, I think, a lot of times lose sight of the fact that, yes, it's a sport. Yes, it's fun. For the fans, it's entertainment. But ultimately, for the people that are collecting paychecks because of this, it's business. And too often we take things personally when we shouldn't, because ultimately it's a business decision. And just like if you or I were offered a job that paid $300 more a week, we would take it.
This radio show would be over.
Yeah. It doesn't mean that we don't like what we're doing. It doesn't mean we don't like the people we work with. It just means you have to do what's right for you. And when you're talking hundreds of dollars a week versus a few more hundreds of dollars a week, that's a big change. If you offer an NHL player $300 more a week, they're going to laugh at you. But players at this level make about the same kind of money that people like you and I make.
Exactly.
So $300 a week is a lot of money.
Where are we going with that?
We can continue the transaction report. You want to do that?
I'm glad you edit your thing so you can edit that horrendous out.
I don't know.
The other thing I want to say is before we now start writing emails and calling the Iceman headquarters because they didn't give Brian Bicek enough money, the flip side is we don't know all the expenses that the Iceman go through. And they have a system. They have an idea of how they want to build this team.
Right.
And they've got a slot. Only so many people can make so much money because you have a salary cap.
Correct.
And you have slots. And guys have to fit in slots. And if they don't want to fit in slots because they can go somewhere else and get paid more money, you can't undo how you're developing a team.
Right.
So all I'm saying is Brian Bicek did nothing wrong and the Evansville Icemen did nothing wrong.
Correct.
They both had to build the team and their careers and their hockey experience the way they need to build it, and it didn't line up.
Right. And that's not to say that the door is completely closed on him coming back in the future, because you never know.
Yep.
Maybe next season's roster building time comes around, and maybe a couple veterans come off the books. Maybe some money comes off the books. Maybe Brian Bicek comes back and says, I'll take a little less money. You never know.
Well,
we could still see him come back, but that there's no guarantee that that's even going to be entertained as an option either. We may never even – Bicek and Crom may never talk again. You never know. It just depends on how things work out, and it's business.
The Iceman had to write, I believe, I don't have proof of this, but to join the ECHL was $1 million check. $1 million. They paid $350,000 to join the CHL. That's not installments over 6 years. That's writing a check. So if we didn't have a lot of money in the budget this year because we wrote $1 million check last June to join the ECHL, you can understand why some of these guys weren't brought back at top dollar.
I could write $1 million check. It'd bounce from here to Cleveland. But I could write one too. But, yeah, and you get over 2 zeros on a check written from me and the bank starts calling. But with Ron Geary, you can get away with that.
And I'm also really excited that Brian's coming back into town. One, he's a really nice guy. He's a great guy. He's going to treat his fans, no matter that he's wearing a K-Wings jersey. His love and his appreciation for Evansville fans is not going to change. I'm sure he's going to be signing everyone's jerseys and saying hello to everybody. But the other thing is, let's see him against this club.
Yeah.
Let's see him against Nathan Moon and against Dylan Clark.
And see how
and
he
Todd Robinson
up.
And Josh Beaulieu. And then have the discussion about how much depth or talent we have
right.
on this club.
And I don't know that one game is going to tell us that, but it would be really interesting, too, when we factor in over the course of the season. We play them a couple more times on the road. We play them three times total at home before the season's over, including two times in the last couple weeks. So it'll be interesting to see how he stacks up against the team head-to-head over the course of the season, and that might play a role in how, if he's going to consider Bisek for the future, how Crum evaluates him going forward.
Now we're up to last Thursday.
Last Thursday in the transactions, Anton Blomqvist got called up to Springfield. Matt Jens was actually moved to the 21-day IR on Thursday. We also signed a goaltender named Ross McKinnon, also from the SPHL Pensacola team, where Donnie Harris came from. He's got really good numbers this year in Pensacola. He's a rookie, and he had a 194 goals against, a 937 save percentage, and an 8-3 record. So if he's forced into action, he might actually be able to compete. We'll see. I'm not 100% sure we're ever actually going to see him start a game, but if Karpovich comes out and lays an egg or gets hurt or something, you never know. We may see McKinnon in action, and he may surprise some people. When that first happened, everybody seemed to think that it was because Karpovich was going to get called up to either called up to Blues camp or called up to Peoria to fill in for someone else who got called up to Blues camp, because apparently he had been telling some fans that he was going to get called up. Well, lo and behold, he wasn't called up. And on Thursday, after they announced the signing of McKinnon, I sent Dave Aminian, who is the beat writer for the Peoria Journal-Star, an email. I've been conversing with him off and on this season about different stuff. I said, do you know anything about the Karpovich deal and why they called him up? Is he going to go to St. Louis? Is he going to go to Peoria? What's happening? And his reply was, he's not going anywhere. I hadn't heard anything about it, and I talked to the Blues, and I talked to Riverman, and neither of them have any plans for him. So maybe the movement is coming on the Columbus side of your affiliation. So lo and behold, that's exactly what the case was, because on Saturday, after a day off of transactions, the Springfield Falcons called up Paul Dayton, Lobster Claws.
Lobster Claws.
And the original reason why they were calling him up, in all likelihood, was that the Blue Jackets were going to call Curtis McElhaney up for training camp. That's not to say that McElhaney would end up starting the season in the NHL, but if they wanted a third goalie in camp, McElhaney was probably going to be the guy. He's been red hot in Springfield. They probably wanted to get a look at him and see, is there something we're missing here? Maybe we should have him on our NHL roster, because he does have a two-way contract. Well, the camp started on Sunday, and that's when McElhaney would have been called up. Before that, he could get called up. On Saturday, he pulled a groin.
Jeez.
So instead of being called up as a lockout replacement, Dayton is now in Springfield as an injury replacement. So Blue Jackets camp is underway. They only have their two goalies, Steve Mason and Sergei Bobrovsky.
The Bob.
The Bob are their two goalies in camp. McElhaney is icing down his groin in Springfield. And the assumption is Dayton will be sent back down whenever Curtis is healthy and back on the ice, but we don't know how long that is. With goalies, groin injuries could be anywhere from 2 weeks to, I don't know, sometimes a month or more. It just depends on how bad the pull was and how well he rehabs it. So we'll get Dayton back eventually, but if McElhaney's injury turns out to be a little bit worse than a low-grade kind of a pull, you never know. We may get to see Ross McKinnon in net a time or two, because While I'm sure Crum would like to stick with Karpovich as much as possible, when you're playing three games in 3 days at times, you can't ride the same goalie every single night, or he'll just get worn down.
And there we see an instance with being an affiliate, and it looks like they got a hold of Crum and said, hey, we got to pull this guy up. We got some things going on. You need to cover yourself. So Crum went out, found himself a goalie to come in and back up, and then the transaction happened. So I'm saying that I don't think we ever have to worry about only having one goalie. Though they did approach Chris Crook and said, hey, we've got a couple of guys in transportation issues. We may have to sign you for the game.
As an emergency backup.
As an emergency backup right out of the men's A-League.
Whew.
Yeah.
And boy, can you imagine if there was a pile up in front of that and Karp looked like he might be hurt?
Yeah.
They'd be cleaning up a puddle on the bench. The only other transaction that we know of through the end of Monday, on Monday, the Falcons sent Blomqvist back down. The AHL transactions page showed it, and the Falcons said it, but it hadn't yet been processed by the ECHL, but it will be in time. So at least Bloomer's back. That gives us five true defensemen,
yep.
So only one will have to play. One forward will have to play back against the Comets tonight unless we somehow sign someone else or I don't know. But I would imagine it'll probably be Kennedy again, and Dale will move back up to forward. We'll see.
That would be my assumption as well.
But that is the transaction and injury report for the Iceman as of the time of this recording. Again, anytime 24/7, you can go to IcemanManiacs.com, click the red graphic with the handicap symbols, and it'll take you to the Maniac message board. Scroll to the end of that there link, and you'll get the updated Iceman roster with call-ups and injuries and all that good jazz. So that's our transaction and injury report, which brings us to...
Well, we've got a hockey game tonight here at the Ford Center against Ford Wayne. We got hockey Friday night as well as Saturday. But we also have NHL hockey Saturday night.
Correct.
Where pretty much all the teams are going to get things going. Toronto plays Montreal, and I believe there is possibly an NBC game on Saturday afternoon. I think Philadelphia.
Saturday and Sunday both.
Okay. So yeah. We've got the lockout is over, and after a feverish 5-day training camp, the NHL is ready to go.
Yeah, and because of NHL training camp starting, it's just thrown everything into a tizzy at the lower levels. I saw the aforementioned Dave Aminian from the Peoria Journal-Star said that on Sunday alone, there were 114 player call-ups from the AHL to the NHL. Now, there were never that many in a single day from the ECHL to the AHL because they kind of trickled in over the course of a week.
Yeah, I wouldn't have wanted to have been that webmaster for the ECHL page trying to write all that up.
Yeah, that would have been rough. So, yeah, all kinds of call-ups from the AHL to the NHL, and that's why there have been so many call-ups from the E to the A. But it's not over yet because NHL teams have to set their 23-man opening day rosters by Friday. Well, when they set their rosters on Friday, that means some guys will have to go back down to the AHL, which will then create a more trickle-down back to the ECHL. So there's been a ton of people that have been called up. A lot of them will probably end up returning, but right now it's still too early to really tell who's going to end up where. It's like I said last week, I think it's going to be another week to 2 weeks probably before the dust really settles on this. This time next week, we'll have a better idea because of a lot of the trickle-down will have still happened, but I think it's still going to be another week or two beyond that before all the tinkering is really done and the dust truly settles. But for now, there is a whole lot to discuss around the ECHL through the end of Monday before all the trickle back down. 11 of the 23 ECHL teams lost their top scorer. And
yep.
We've talked about it before in preparation for the possibility of the lockout ending that we thought the Icemen would probably be hurt less than a lot of the other teams, and that has turned out to be true. Yeah, we lost Paul Dayton, but that was due to injury, and he'll be back. We lost Blomqvist, but he's back already. Our only real losses due to the lockout are Wade McLeod, who we never really expected to be here in the first place.
The Highlander.
Yes.
He's awesome.
Yes, he is. Cody Beach and Brett Ponich to Peoria. So that's the three that have gone up. And the expectation is once the Blues camp ends and they send whoever back down to Peoria, the Rivermen will be one over the roster limit. So we'll get someone back, likely a Ford. And my guess would be it will be Beach, but it could be somebody else if they decide to keep him in the AHL. One way or the other, it's pretty likely that our net loss due to the lockout, if you don't count McLeod, who we never expected to have here long-term anyway, maybe Brett Ponich, and that's it. So considering how some of the other teams have been hurt, things could be a heck of a lot worse. So taking a look around the division, I went through every day's transactions and tallied them up. In the division, Fort Wayne got hit harder than anybody else. They're already without Captain Colin Chalk due to injury. Their top goal scorer, Thomas Beauregard, is also out due to injury. And then on top of that, they have had eight players called up to the AHL, including... number one scorer, Brandon Marino. Number two scorer, Josh Bertain. And number four scorer, Jean-Michel Rizk. So three of their top four scorers are out. Now, we don't know how long they'll be up there. But for right now, as of when we record this, only one of their top eight scorers are on the active roster. So they've really been hit hard. Now, a couple of those are due to injury, but still. That team is right now the rotting carcass of
yes.
The Fort Wayne Comets. So The Icemen have no excuse to not beat them tonight. Elsewhere around the division, the Cincinnati Cyclones lost six skaters and a goalie. Among the skaters is their top scorer. The Kalamazoo Wings also lost six skaters, including top scorer Eric Catalyst. And the Toledo Walleye lost six skaters, including two of their top five scorers. So everyone else in the division got hit harder than we did. So hopefully that bodes well for the Icemen going forward. If you look around the Eastern Conference, I think the hardest hit team was Florida. They lost eight players, including one top five scorer, and they are now down to only four of their top 11 scorers on the active roster due to injuries and call-ups. Elmira lost six players, including two top five scorers and their number one goalie. Wheeling lost seven players, including three top fives, including their number one scorer. Reading lost four. They didn't get hit hard offensively, but they lost both of their goalies.
That's tough.
Yeah. Greenville lost three, including their number two scorer, who is ninth in the league in scoring. Gwinnett lost five, including two top five scorers. Orlando lost four, including one top five scorer.
Was one of them Dan Gender?
No, he is still there.
Okay.
Trenton lost eight players, although none of their top scorers, so that's just more of a depth issue than anything with them. South Carolina, the last team on my list here, they lost five, including their number one and number two scorers, but I thought the interesting thing about them was they lost forwards named Jared Knight and Hunter Bishop, so they're a couple pieces short of a full chess set. So that's the wrap-up for the Eastern Conference. Out west, Alaska got hit hardest. They are an independent team, but they had four NHL ringers on their roster, including number one scorer Joey Crabb. So they got hit pretty hard. Utah lost 10, including their top scorer and two others who were in their top five. So they got to hope some guys get sent back down. Ontario lost five, including both of their goalies. Idaho lost five, including their top scorer, who is second in the league in scoring. They also lost their second leading scorer, and they've kind of got a goalie platoon, a 1A and a 1B, but the 1A got called up, so they got hit pretty hard. San Francisco lost six players. Technically, they lost seven, but one of those was Ryan Clough, an NHL player who actually hadn't played a game for them, so I didn't count him. But they lost six players, including one of their top five scorers. Las Vegas and Stockton both only lost three, but they both lost their top scorers. And Bakersfield, who are in last place by a mile and couldn't afford to lose anybody, thankfully for them, they only lost one player, and he was a top five scorer, but they escaped mostly unscathed. The only team that, technically speaking, has not lost a player since the lockout ended is the Colorado Eagles. However, there's an asterisk there, because on December 18th, they lost Chad Costello and Jack Combs, their top two scorers, who were also 1-2 in the league, who were tearing it up. Costello had 49 points in 27 games.
Jeez.
Combs had 42 points in 27 games. Now, I don't know if that's because they played Bakersfield a lot or what, but the number one and two scorers in the league got called up to Bridgeport in the AHL on December 18th, but they got called up on professional tryout contracts, which implied they could end up coming back down. Well, now that the lockout's over, Bridgeport has upgraded both of them to standard contracts, and they're probably not coming back down the rest of the season. So even though Colorado technically hasn't lost anyone because of the lockout since it ended, they really permanently lost their top two guys, which is going to hurt them a lot too.
Another thing to remember is just because the NHL season starts on Saturday doesn't mean ourselves or any of the other teams are out of the water. As soon as there's a, if we have an odd trade, 3-for-2 or 4-for-2, and they throw in a couple of prospect pieces in the trade, then we could see more movement of going up and down. And there's already been two trades pulled off in the NHL. There's rumors of the big Luongo to Toronto deal, and there can be all kinds of other things as teams get set up for this sprint of a 48-game season.
Yeah, 48 games and 99 calendar days. So it's going to be
one every other night. It's good to be a fan.
It's going to be good to be a fan after the hell of the lockout, but it's going to be really fun to see, and it's going to be wild to see how things shake out because, it's going to be fast and furious.
And then the one thing that, talking about the business side of it, Montreal Canadiens took forward Scott Gomez and they're going to buy him out, but the buyout can't happen until next year.
Right, they're stuck with him this year.
So, but they sent him home because if he's injured, they can't buy him out. So he was playing for the Alaska Aces in the ECHL. They are honoring his contract, so he will make his prorated $7 million over the 48 games, so roughly about $3 million, sitting on the couch. He cannot play any hockey anywhere because he is under NHL contract, but he can't play any hockey at all.
And at his age, his career might be over.
Yeah.
Once they buy him out, I don't know that anyone, unless he is willing to take a bargain basement contract,
which
he might.
Because he's getting $7 million up front in one check. But yeah, it's going to be, but that's just part of the thing. I saw an interview with the GM of the Canadiens. And he said, you know, it's horrible. You got to tell a guy he can't play hockey, and you know he can play hockey, but you just have to shut him down. So he can't even go back to the ECHL or over to Russia or Sweden or anything.
Right. And again, like we were talking earlier, that's a business decision. That doesn't mean they hate Scott Gomez. That doesn't mean there's some sort of personal problem there. It's just that the Canadiens have to do what's right for business. And if they allow him to play and then he gets hurt and they can't buy him out, they're on the hook for another year, and it really sets him back even more.
Well, the biggest thing is in the new CBA, the big year is next year where the cap goes down to $60 million. Yeah. And there is a lot of teams with a lot of big contracts that are scared. Now, they get a two-buyout amnesty.
Right.
So you can buy out people, and it goes into this $10 million slush fund thing that they've got set up for next year.
Yeah, so it's going to be really interesting. I think that's just the first of many. I think there's going to be a lot of other ugly contracts that come off the books because teams are going to have to get really creative to get under the cap, because I think the last I saw was that there were like 11 teams that had already, a year out, committed more money to the cap than what the cap is going to end up being. And that's not even taking into account that they've got more roster spots to fill. So there's going to be some buyouts, and it's going to be really interesting. There may be some free agents on the market that other teams can sign cheap because they're going to be getting a lot of money in buyouts. So they may be willing to take less money to play.
And that's why I can see, like, look at Minnesota, who just signed two 10-year, 12-year, $100 million guys in Zach Parise and
Ryan Suter.
So who's going to give up? You know, they're going to need three or four guys to compensate for that. So you have Columbus that wants Ryan Suter, a defenseman, or Zach Parise. So they trade three guys for them because they can take on that contract. And now here goes all the guys getting moved up from the Icemen and from the AHL club.
If you trade three guys whose salary totals $10 million for one guy whose salary is $10 million, that's how that balance will come out. Someone else fills extra roster spots for the same amount of money to get under the cap. Yep. And then a team like a Columbus could get a superstar player that they maybe couldn't have gotten under the old system.
So, our second segment of Shockers Hockey Rock Song of the Week.
This is, speaking of what we were just talking about, in honor of the return of the NHL. The season, like we said, begins Saturday, 48 games over 99 days. The playoffs will start on April 30th, and they say the Stanley Cup Finals will be over by the end of June. So, in honor of the NHL's return, I'm going to spin a couple of classic ESPN hockey themes. The first is the National Hockey Night theme from ESPN, the flagship. And the second is perhaps a lesser-known theme from the old Fire on Ice hockey coverage on ESPN2. Here we go.
Michael Shockley. And Daddy.
Back on Iceman Insights, Michael Shockley, the Dirty D. All of your Iceman information, the longest hour of hockey talk in the nation.
By the way, I want to mention, we didn't actually reference it last week, but at least in the podcast version of the show, I believe you aired it on the on-air airing too, the introduction by one Ivy.
Yes, indeed. Yeah,
I thought that was really cute. And I might just introduce the third segment with that every week because it's so darn cute.
That's what I was planning on too. And also we are in preparations and contract discussions for the Ivy radio show.
Ooh.
Which will be all the insights on all things Disney and Barbie princesses, as well as all of her favorite Journey songs.
And the Blinky Shoe segment of the week.
Yes, Blinky Shoe segment of the week. And probably a segment about that stinking mommy. So we want to get out the little fan information here. Troy Seibert, good buddy of mine, wanted to know some stats on faceoffs and how the Icemen have held up against their opponents this year. So you ask, and Michael Shockley does all the work.
So basically you're playing the Derek Benigni role.
Yeah, that's what I do.
Yeah, for those that don't know, this is part of what I do for Rich Crum, is I sit up in the press box at all the home games only, I don't go to the road games, but I sit up in the press box, and every time there's a face-off, I determine if we won or lost it, and for each face-off, I write down the Iceman player, the opposing player, what zone it's in, be it attack, neutral, or defensive, and then whether or not we won or lost the draw, and first off, before I go into the stats, I think we have to define how you win or lose a draw. And essentially, to me, the win or loss of a faceoff is who comes away with the first possession after the puck is dropped. Now, that's not to say that if you immediately get the possession and then turn the puck over, you lost the draw. It's if you have the first clean chance at playing the puck and doing something with it according to plan, whether it goes according to plan or not, that means you won the draw. But I also account for context. Like if you're in the defensive zone on the penalty kill and the center is clearly trying to chip the puck forward and out of the zone on the draw, if he does that, even if the first possession, quote-unquote, is the other team, if he clears it out of the zone successfully, I'm giving him the win. And a lot of times it's not just the center. You may look at a center and see that he was under 50% on draws, but a lot of winning faceoffs at this level comes down to your wingers and how well they come in and help out. So a bad win-loss in a game here or there isn't necessarily about the center alone. Now, over time, when you have an aggregate of a larger number of statistics, if a guy is well under 50%, then maybe he's just not very good on draws, and vice versa. If he's well over 50%, then probably he's pretty good on draws. But here and there, you're going to have some nights where the wingers just don't pinch well or something just doesn't, and a matchup doesn't work out well, and some guy that's normally really good on draws might have a bad night. But kind of in general, just to look at the stats for those who maybe just want to know, how many do we have in a game? It seems there's whistles and stoppages and goals and offsides and icing, and how many times over the course of a game is there faceoff? Well, this season so far, the average per game is 60.6 faceoffs, which essentially equates to 20 per period. The high this season in the home games was 76 in the home opener against the Comets. The low was 47 on October 24th against Gwinnett. So generally that basically 50 to 70 range is an average game. And like I said, the average is essentially 60. Last season's average was a little bit higher at 62.4 per game, but we did have five games that went to overtime at home last year. We haven't had any overtime games at home this year, so that's part of that difference. So more or less the number of whistles and thus faceoffs per game has been pretty much the same this year compared to last year. If you take the average of 60 per game and extrapolate that out over a 72-game season, that equates to over 4,300 total faceoffs for a single team in a season. And when you look at that number of 4,300 and consider every time there's a faceoff, that's an opportunity to win or lose initial possession of the puck. When you're a puck possession team and maybe you're a little bit short on talent, faceoffs take on an added level of importance. If you can win more draws, get more possessions, and make things a little bit easier for yourselves. So, looking at the team stats for the Icemen, in 22 home games so far this season, the Icemen are 729 and 604 on faceoffs. That's 54.7%. Last season in 35 home games, we were 1205 and 979, which is 55.2%. So down a half a percent this season. So more or less on par with how we did last year on draws. Now, granted, you really should be over 50% at home because the home center has the advantage as far as putting the stick down second. So in theory, you should be around 52 to 55% at home and 45 to 48% on the road. So I don't know what the road numbers are, but that's what the home numbers are, and that's about where you would expect them to be. By game, if you basically establish a win, loss, or tie based on whether we were over, under, or at 50% each game, the Icemen have been over 50% in 16 of 22 home games this year, so that's pretty good. Under 50% in 5, and one game was 50-50. So that's 16-5-1 if you want to draw it up like that. Last season we were 35-0. 35-0. So we've already got our five games that we've been under 50% that matches last year, but still pretty solid numbers so far this year. The best game was October 19th against Trenton. We were plus 26 on draws that night, won 42 and lost 16. The worst game was only a minus 7. We went 32 and 39 on December 29th against Cincinnati. So the best game is a heck of a lot better than the worst game is bad.
Yep.
I also break the numbers down by zone. We are 58.1% in the attack zone, 54.5% in the defensive zone, and 51% in the neutral zone, which is pretty much on par with where we were last year. We were 60% in the attack zone last year, the best, 54% in the defensive zone, and 50.7% in the neutral zone. So the numbers in general and by zone are pretty much where they were last season. If you just look at the number of faceoffs per zone, this year we've had 35.9% of all faceoffs at home have been in the defensive zone, 34.2% in the attack zone, and 29.9% in the neutral zone. And again, that's pretty much on par with last year. It was 35.7 in the D, 34.8 in the attack, and 29.3 in the neutral. So all these numbers, last year versus this year, on a team level, are pretty much the same. Which pretty much tells you, I guess, since the team won so much last year and is losing so much this year, faceoffs ultimately don't tell you much.
The ones that I think that sticks out, though, is games over 50% to games under 50%.
Yeah.
And this year we're at 16-5-1, last year 30-5-1. And you just think about last year's team where we had Nick Lindberg as that second line center, yeah, and Brian Bicek as that second line right winger.
Mm-hmm.
And that just kind of shows, and then Mario Bouillard and the two tough
and
wingers.
Malcolm Gulliam, yeah, played on the third line a lot.
And so you build that team with strength and depth through that center position, and good things happen. And we don't see it. You know, it doesn't automatically show up on the scoreboard, but you can see where you're beginning to dominate play possession because you have good centers and good wingers winning draws.
Right. So looking at it on an individual player level, another way of telling just how crazy this season's been from a transaction standpoint, we've already had 15 different players that have taken at least one faceoff at home this season. Last year, the whole season, we only had 11. So that's just another stat that tells you how crazy it's been. Eight players have taken at least 10 draws, and anything under 10, I don't really draw much about. It's just too small of a sample size. So of the eight players who have taken 10 or more draws, the best on the team is actually not a regular center. It's Josh Beaulieu. He's 51-29, which is 63.8%. He was also number one on the team last season. He was 51-22, which is 69.9% last year.
You see him take that draw a lot on the power play, too.
Yeah.
There's
a lot of times when him and Todd and Baker or someone else are the three forwards, a lot of times Todd will just tap Bo on the behind, on the hindquarters, on the keister, and tell him to go take the draw. And I think a lot of times it's based on which side of the net you're on, because Todd likes to draw it back one way and Beaulieu will draw it back the other way. So it depends on where the faceoff is located. But yeah, Beaulieu, he's been consistently very good on faceoffs, even though he doesn't really take them all that often. The best among the regular centers is Todd Robinson. He's 253 and 188, which is 57.4%, which is very solid. Now, granted, part of that is because he's often taking draws on the power play. Same thing with Beaulieu. If you're taking more draws on the power play, well, it's 5-on-4, so there's more likelihood you're going to come away with the first possession. Because if you don't win the faceoff clean and it squirts out to a side and players are fighting for it, there's one more guy that you have to fight for it than the other team. So that plays a little bit of a role, but still, Todd is very good.
Yeah, he's very good, and for 2 years I've done the inter-squad scrimmage games during training camp, and he just gets this look in his eye when he wants to win it. And he just wins it back. Sometimes if the goalie isn't quite paying attention in the offensive zone, he'll try to snipe in short side post or far side, and man, you just drop that puck and it's gone. And mm-hmm. and he's been winning them back all day long, and all of a sudden he wins it forward. I've seen him put it through a guy's foot one time in an inter-squad scrimmage, won it forward, picked it up himself, passed through the legs of the winger, slam dunk goal for his winger cut into the net. He's really good.
Yeah, and so much of that is just vision, and we've talked before about how well he sees the ice, and that even happens. He's seeing the ice well before the play has even started. That's what comes into play there with him winning draws in different ways based on the context of the situation. So, 57.4% for him. That's down a little bit. He was 58.3% last season. But a part of that, the drop for him, is because of his knee. He was 149 and 84, which is almost 64% this season before his knee injury. Since he came back from the knee injury, he's right at 50%, 104 and 104. So, I think that's proof that winning a faceoff isn't just about your hands. It's a lot about your torque and the way you move with your lower body, too. So hopefully, as his knee gets healthier, he'll get kind of back to where he was on draws, because 64% to 50% is a pretty sizable drop. Also, I think, in general, Todd's numbers show a little bit about how his role is different this season compared to last season, because last year, he took 44.3% of the team's faceoffs. This season, he's only at 33.1% of the team's faceoffs. Now, that's overall. If you take out the two games he missed at home because of injury, even in the 20 games he's played, he's only at 36.3%. So that's an 8% drop in just the number of faceoffs that he's taking compared to last season. I think part of that is he's been killing penalties less this year. We've seen some other guys step up that have been killing penalties more often. And also, I think the team is just a little more balanced with the 5-on-5, the forward lines are more balanced. So you're not necessarily seeing Crom feel the need to go to his top two lines more and only play the third line sparingly. There were times last season where that third energy line would only get two or three shifts a period.
Yep.
And this year, he's pretty much rolling three lines the whole game, which over time will just take numbers away from Todd that last year he would have had. So Todd's the number one center. The other current centers, Jason Dale is 148 and 122, which is 54.8%. Anthony Nigro is 33 and 32, 50.8%. And Dylan Clark is the only one of the regulars who has been struggling. He's 70 and 90, which is only 43.8%. Others with 10 or more faceoffs this season, Dale Mahovsky was 94 and 78, which is 54.7% before he got traded. Before he got called up early in the season, Brett Sonny was 50 and 36, which is 58%. And the only other player that's taken more than 10 is Nathan Moon. He's 12 and 15, which is 44.4%. Looking at individuals who had the best games, the best game all season was not Todd Robinson. Todd's best game is November 2nd against Wheeling. He was 26-7. And then the next game on November 6th against Greenville, he was 17-4. So that was a really strong two-game stretch. But the best individual faceoff game all season was actually Dale Mahovsky. On October 19th against Trenton, he went 15-1 on draws, which is one heck of a performance in the circle. For those who are kind of wondering, I went back and just jotted down a couple numbers, too, from last season. Last year, as I said, Todd was 58.3%. Beaulieu was 69.9%. Nicholas Lindberg took the bulk of the draws. Otherwise, he was 357 and 315, which is 53.1%. Brian Bisek was 78 and 69, which is also 53.1%. And Mario Ballard, who was primarily the center for the third line, was 110 and 119, which is 48%. So that's the numbers of note that I wrote down. I have a bunch of other numbers in a spreadsheet that if you had a particular question, you can ask it. Go to the Iceman Maniacs Facebook page or the Maniac Asylum, and when I post this episode as a podcast with the link on in the afternoon after this all airs on WYIR, if you want to reply with additional questions about the faceoffs, feel free, and if it's something that I have numbers for, I'll try to answer it. So that's what I got on the draw. You got any responses about that?
Nope. I think I pretty much covered everything I needed to say. I have a question about our next segment because okay. I think it's wrong.
Oh, really?
But should let just blow us away with this Iceman trivia.
All right. The question is, in the five-year history of the Evansville Icemen, who are the only two players who have played for the team in three different seasons?
And as I stall here, as I'm going through names and faces, what I find difficult is we were in the AHA League or the AAHL for two seasons. Then we made the jump to the CHL, which was that expansion CHL team when we play in Swanders. Mm-hmm. And then another year in the CHL in Ford Center, and this year
in the ECHL
in the Ford Center. And I didn't think anyone was on that team from the old Swander that is still on that team now, and I didn't think anyone from the old AHA League made it to Swander to the CHL.
The latter is correct. No one from the AHA League made the jump to the CHL. Two players from both that played both CHL seasons made the jump to the ECHL.
Wow. And I'm just trying to go through the names, and I am officially stumped. So now I'm going to prove you wrong. Because I'm never wrong. Ask my wife.
The two players who played in three different seasons are Mark Cody.
That's one.
And Jake Obermeyer.
Oh, he was on that team?
Yes. Cody is the only one of the two who actually started all three seasons with the team. He started the first CHL season with the Icemen and has been here since. Obermeyer did not start that first season with the team. We traded for him mid-season. But he has now played parts of in three different seasons. So those are your two, Mark Cody and Jake Obermeyer. Yeah.
And it's documented. I am officially wrong for the first time ever.
The interesting thing is, even though they're the only two that have played three different seasons, neither one of them is the all-time franchise leader in games played.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise
me. No. The most games played in the history of the Icemen is 130 by Nicholas Lindbergh. Which means Jennifer Watts' ears just perked up, even though she can't hear this. Number two on the games played list is Brian Bisek with 124. So those are the top two in games played, but Cody and Obermeyer are the only two who have played in three different seasons. They're both under 100 total games played, though, for the Icemen, so they're not quite to the top of that list.
Now, we air a brand new segment, hopefully a weekly segment, in our drive to get Iceman equipment manager, Iceman athletic trainer.
Yes.
And friend of the radio program, Brian Patafi, to 1,000 Twitter followers. He is currently at 85. The Brian Patafi Tweet of the Week.
Yes, this is a new segment we're going to do because Mr. Patafi is quite the entertainer on Twitter.
He's quite the entertainer, period.
In general, yeah. You can follow him at twitter.com/bpatafi. That's B-P-A-T-A-F-I-E, for those who don't know how to spell Patafi. And if you follow him, you will get wonderful insights such as this. You alluded to it earlier. Just over the weekend, Brian Patafi tweeted, quote, "In Elmira, not commenting on the women here, but I just won a Taylor Swift lookalike contest."
End quote. Yeah, I saw that and showed it to my wife, and we were just in hysterics.
Yeah.
And he's got some classics. So
yeah.
Has got to be the toughest week to pick.
Because there were some good ones. Yes. You can't say the other ones, though, because I might want to use them in the future.
So you're not going to... His tweet of the week isn't after his segment week. Here in a half an hour.
Right.
And then...
Right. I got to bank some good ones in case there's a week where he goes on vacation or something. So we can't blow any of the good ones that he's already posted.
Rats.
So, yeah, you can follow Patafi at twitter.com/bpatafi. You can also, for those interested, follow Iceman Equipment Manager Jeff Smoke Adams. His Twitter handle is smoke_dog11. So smoke_dogg11 is his Twitter. And he's not a fan of Elmira either. I actually saw on Saturday he tweeted, "Best way to see Elmira? In the rearview mirror."
Nice.
So Patafi's not the only one who was not a fan of visiting Elmira. But on the topic of Patafi, that fun fact about Mr. Patafi, last Wednesday at the game against the Comets, he gave me his business card. And he's technically the athletic trainer for the Icemen. His business card's title is not athletic trainer. It says he is the, quote, coordinator of injury management.
There you go. That's so, what he does.
Yeah, that's
I've seen
That's
it do him. I've seen him do it while he's in the middle of a radio interview.
So there we go. The Brian Patafi tweet of the week. That's the debut, and hopefully it will be a weekly thing as long as he continues to churn out goofy and entertaining tweets that are worth sharing here. And also safe to share on the radio.
Yeah, they should all be pretty much safe. And he's all in fun, and he's a good guy.
Yeah.
One thing that I'm excited for the game tonight against Fort Wayne, but last week in the game against Fort Wayne, and I was giving a little tour of the facilities to Maggie Spaeth, the lucky woman that got to marry ECHL linesman Matt Spaeth. But up in the press box, I was showing her around, introducing her around, and there's Tim Taylor hanging
out. Yeah, Tim Taylor, who is the, not to be confused with Tim Taylor, the host of Tool Time, Tim Taylor, the former NHL player who is now the director of player development for the St. Louis Blues. He was in the press box watching that game between the Icemen and Comets. For those who don't know who Tim Taylor is, he played over 700 NHL games and twice won the Stanley Cup. He was a team captain for a long time, so he knows what he's talking about. So he's a
very
good guy.
Good face-off winner as well.
Yes, he
in
was.
His day.
Yeah. So he was up in the box watching that game, taking some notes about the Blues prospects that the Icemen have. And something interesting that came up during that game when he was sitting there at the one end of the press box, I was on the end, and next to me was Steve Ford from the Courier and Press, and next to him was Tim Taylor. And at one point in the game, one of the Fort Wayne players took a shot, and it hit Nathan Moon's stick and snapped it in half. When that happened, Steve Ford, who's still new to hockey, turned to me and asked how much sticks cost. I said, well, generally $150 to $200. And I don't think he necessarily thought that was legit. He thought maybe I was blowing smoke up his rear, that they're not really that expensive. So he turned to Tim Taylor and said, is that's real? They're $150 to $200? And Tim confirmed that, yes, they are indeed that expensive, sometimes even more. And I thought this was interesting. He then went on to say, and this is one of those things you only know if you just happen to come across a guy who actually works for an NHL team. Tim said that just for sticks alone, the average NHL team budgets $600,000 to $700,000 per season.
I believe it.
That is crazy.
Yep.
And I think part of that is because of the transition to graphite. Because the materials that the sticks are made now are meant to have so much flex in them so that you get more torque and faster shots. That
well,
because
it's
they
the
flex,
lightweight, too.
Yeah,
the
and they're very
is.
Light. And they're made so that they draw, they will bend, but that also means they break a heck of a lot easier. And you didn't see nearly as many sticks break back in the day when everybody used wood, which, like,
no.
Al MacInnis was probably one of the last players in the NHL to use wood, and boy, he had a heck of a shot as a result. But
actually, Adrian Acoin is the last player
in
the NHL.
Does he still use wood?
And I don't think last year when I watched, I think he had a graphite twig. But
really?
Up to 2 years ago, he was still one of the few guys left carrying a wood stick.
I wonder who even makes those.
Oh, they
now?
Still make them. They're hard to get. They actually are hard to get.
I would
they
imagine.
Still make them, but they are so far inferior to these new lightweight
oh, yeah.
sticks. You just feel like a beast. Even I feel like a beast in the men's A League when you have that $200 stick. It is so lightweight. Everything just you shoot the puck harder. You're not fighting the stick and the weight of the stick.
It makes me glad that they didn't have them when I played, because when I was playing high school hockey, I had the best slap shot on my team, and there were times that my teammates... It was like when Fulton Reed wound up in the Mighty Ducks, because I had a heck of a shot as far as speed, but it wasn't always on target. So my teammates would literally jump out of the way. One time I did hit a teammate in the side of the helmet, and he was a little woozy for a few minutes.
And still on the bench.
And yeah. Yeah. Very nice. And yeah, that was with, at the time, an aluminum stick when Easton first, aluminum was the first alternative material after they had wood sticks. So at the time I was using aluminum sticks, but I could have probably killed somebody if we'd had graphite sticks back
then. They're awesome.
I'm sure. I've never actually taken a shot with one, and I'm kind of scared to.
I was up in the press box and saw Tim Taylor, and I wanted to say hi to him, but I couldn't think of anything that wasn't just ridiculously fan cliche, so I just passed.
Yeah, when in doubt, keep your mouth shut.
Yep.
Someone once told me it's better to keep one's mouth closed and be assumed an idiot than to open it and remove all doubt.
Yes, indeed.
A couple other little things to get to here at the end of the show. We mentioned last week the Evansville Thunder Pee Wee team went to the International Silver Sticks Tournament up in Forest, Ontario over the weekend. Unfortunately, they did lose all three of their games, although two of their losses were to the two teams that ended up playing in the championship finals. So no shame in that. Still wonderful just to have a team that qualified for that. Also in the area, the Owensboro Puck Hogs Pee Wee team in a different Pee Wee tier played in Pelham, Ontario over the weekend, and they actually ended up being the runners-up in their tournament bracket. So congratulations to them for bringing home the silver, I guess. They advanced to the championship, lost 4-2 to a team from Casper, Wyoming. So, but still, good for the Thunder, good for the Puck Hogs.
Great experience
win or lose,
for
it's
the
wonderful,
kids.
Yeah.
And all the parents made it back without DUIs or anything like that. Or being trapped in a bus with 18 10-year-olds.
They didn't do anything that made sure that they wouldn't be allowed back in the country or deported back to the country. That's good. Yeah, I know from when I played youth hockey, the tournaments like that, when you go on a longer road trip like that, years later you don't remember if you won or lost. You just remember the experience of the trip, and it's so much fun going on the road with your friends and that team building type stuff. And I have fond memories of going and staying in hotels and having scrawny little teammates of mine trying to pick up high school girls in the pool. And it's just a lot of fun stuff. So congratulations to them. Hope everybody had a good, fun, safe trip, win or lose. Still great to represent the area.
The Thunder Pee Wee team at the Canadian border on the way home got stopped and had all the parents removed from the bus, and they left just the kids with their birth certificates on the bus, and they were all interviewed by police officers.
Seriously?
Seriously. And one of the stud little defenseman, Nate Gamutza, said that one of the police officers came up to him and said, "Do you want to go to jail?" And he replied, "No, sir."
Was it, "Do you want to go to jail," or "Do you want to go to jail A?"
No, it might have probably been A. More
depends
likely.
On who, which side the...
It was the Canadian
was
side.
Was it a Mountie?
So, yeah. Dudley Do-Right.
There we go. Nice reference.
Hey, how about that?
I used to play the Dudley Do-Right theme at Swander every now and then. Yeah. When the official...
Look at that. We're already plugging next week's Shockers Hockey Rock Song of the Week.
Yeah, we're going to play Dudley Do-Right theme and the Mountie song by the Arrogant Worms. There we go. No, we're not. One last little thing I want to get to. It's time to play a little game I like to call Guess How Long It Is.
Oh, my gosh.
And no, Mr. Benigni, the answer is not 4.5 inches. Get your head out of the gutter. This is something I posted on The Asylum last week, last Tuesday, before last week's episode aired. I asked on The Maniac Asylum how long the show would be to solicit guesses from people. And a whole lot of people thought we would go longer than 2 hours last week. And we only ended up going 1 hour, 22 minutes, and 13 seconds.
A little less if you listen to the live broadcast.
Yeah, because it got chopped down. But the podcast was 1:22:13. And the thing was, whoever was closest, not without going over, we didn't play Price is Right rules, whoever was closest would get a name drop on this week's show. So there were a bunch of responses. Everyone guessed too high. Not a single person was low. But the closest guess to our hour and 22 was by Pam Massey. She guessed 1 hour and 36 minutes and change. So we're mentioning Pam Massey. Here's your name.
Congratulations.
Yes, congratulations. The grand prize of all grand prizes. There's nothing that's worth more than having your name dropped on this show, because Lord knows we never mention anyone else by name.
Unless you really screwed up bad.
Yeah, that's true. Usually when you get your name dropped on this show, you're getting thrown under the bus. So congratulations,
like
Pam Massey.
Like Kevinsville. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
He's still having nightmares. He's still posting on Facebook from the bruises.
Upcoming games tonight. Here we go. Fort Wayne, Ford Center, and then this weekend, the return of Brian Bicek. So excited Friday night, and then we've got the Fish roll in Saturday night.
Yep, three games in 4 days, all at home, all within the division. These are actually our last three games before the All-Star break, because next Wednesday is the All-Star game. Brad Perkins. And we really...
He's a hockey god. We can't talk bad about him true. Because...
You can't throw God under the bus.
No, you can't. He'll pick up that bus and throw it right back on top of you.
There you go.
Do not mess with the hockey god.
So, yeah, we really need to win these games, need to keep the home game winning streak going, because after the All-Star break, only 11 of the Icemen's last 29 games are at home. So a lot of road games, a lot of traveling. So need to win these games and take some positive momentum into the break. We've been doing well so far in January, just need to keep it going. But tonight's game, yeah, against the Comets, it is Military Appreciation Night, as mentioned earlier. Friday against Kalamazoo and Brian Bicek. And not Matt Pierce.
Shut it.
Is NASCAR night and supposedly an Iceman player poster giveaway to the first 1,500 fans. I don't know any details about that, but that's been announced. And then Saturday against Toledo, no promotions have been announced for that. But it's a Saturday and it's the Iceman. What more do you want?
That's it. Again, we want to say congratulations to Drew and Ashley Campbell. At their wedding last Saturday, and they actually had to sell their tickets to, I believe it was Drew's brother.
Really?
Or cousin. Yeah, he took over the tickets for the three home games while they are listening to Iceman Insights and the Amusement Park here on WYIR.com as they bathe in the sun in sunny Orlando, Florida.
Yeah. Congratulations, Drew and Ashley. It was a lot of fun, and may your lives bring you years and years of wedded bliss. And also, I do have to say, credit where credit is due, Mr. Benigni here did a fantastic job officiating that ceremony. It was wonderful. So for those of you who may be in the market for someone to officiate your wedding ceremony, get in touch with the Dirty D. Because despite what he may put out there over the air on this show, he's actually a wonderful man and a wonderful officiant for a wedding ceremony. So
I only do friends, though, so if you're a D-bag, don't call me.
Yeah, if you're Mike Liambus from the Orlando Solar Bears.
I'm not doing his wedding.
Okay, gotcha.
Do you have any last thoughts?
Nope.
I guess not.
All quiet right on the Ivy front. One last thing I did want to say, too. For those of you who are looking for a fantasy hockey league to play in this truncated NHL season, there is an Iceman Maniacs Fantasy Hockey League. You can go to IcemanManiacs.com, click over to the Maniac message board. There are only 10 spots to fill. Registration deadline is tomorrow, Thursday the 17th at 4 o'clock. The draft is tomorrow night at 6:45, since we have a home game tonight and home games Friday and Saturday, and the season starts Saturday. Tomorrow night is really our only chance to get the draft in. So tomorrow night at 6:45 is the draft. 4 o'clock is the registration deadline. Season starts on Saturday. So if you want to play, it's free. It's fun. Go to IcemanManiacs.com, click over to the Maniac message board, and all the info's there.
He is the Michael Shockley, senior writer, webmaster, IcemanManiacs.com for all the information you could ever need about your Evansville Iceman.
And a lot you don't need.
You can check him out there. He is also the vice president of Offbeat Shenanigans. Thank you much for listening to Iceman Insights. Right here on WYIR, the Amusement Park.
We'll see you on the radio.
The puck is in. The home team wins the good old hockey game.